Hi, this is Tim.
And I'm Wendy.
And welcome to the Foster Parenting Podcast.
We created this show to educate and inform our friends, family,
and anyone who wants to listen
about our lives as foster parents.
Podcast. That was funny, huh? Where'd that come from?
What?
Didn't you hear my voice go up in...
No,
pitch?
But thanks for pointing it out.
Well, I just want everybody to know that I heard it myself.
That your voice cracked.
That my voice cracked.
Interesting. I was looking at books on Amazon today, and there's a book about training your voice to sound different when you talk.
Really?
Why, yes, there is, Tim. And, okay, full disclosure, I was looking for books on public speaking because that's a skill I want to continue to work on. And that was a book that came up. And rather than spend the $14 on a book, of course, I went to the library website. They did not have it on the library website.
So you went with the Interlibrary Exchange and ordered it from New Jersey?
I could. Thank you for that. I just took a moment to grieve it a little bit. The book just came out a couple months ago, so I thought maybe I'll double check that again in a few months. And I wasn't planning to modify my voice. But since you mentioned your self-consciousness at your voice cracking, Christmas!
So two things just to let the readers, listeners in on. We think it's kind of mind-boggling that there is such a thing as interlibrary exchange, that you can have a library ship a book from out of state to your library.
Right.
For, you know, for the cost of the book shipping.
Yeah, because they will spend in their time and shipping the same as it would cost you to buy the book. Right?
Yep. And they'll do that for you for minimal cost.
But, yeah. But you do pay for it.
With taxes?
With your taxes, yeah.
Oh, okay. But, yeah.
So I'm already paying for it. I might as well do that. I'll try it and I'll let you know how it works, guys.
I mean, libraries are kind of mind-boggling to begin with. That, like, with very little evidence, they just, you know, very little evidence about who you are. They just let you take things.
That's true.
But then the
utility bill.
But then that some other library in some other state will say, yeah, we'll send you our book
right
to your library right to give it to your random guy. Like, right. That's weird.
You know, I'm just feeling like probably people saw that there was an episode right before Christmas and they clicked on it and they're like so glad to hear us talking about libraries right now.
Well, I wanted to mention about your voice control thing.
Yeah.
I was watching or listening to the 60 Minutes podcast and they had Meryl Streep talking about her portrayal of Margaret Thatcher.
Okay.
And Margaret Thatcher actually retrained her voice for public speaking.
Ah.
Because she had a soft, effeminate British voice, and it wasn't good for public speaking. And she retrained it to sound like this.
Maybe there's multiple books like this, and maybe there's a listener who knows of a book that might be in my library. So maybe they could comment. That could be your Christmas gift to me. So Merry Christmas, everyone.
Merry Christmas. It's Christmas time when you're told, I wish I was never adopted.
Yep.
Days before Christmas.
Yeah. Did Santa see that?
I don't remember that being in the Santa Claus song.
We had a hard bedtime tonight.
It's just been a hard couple days.
Yep.
They've been on winter break for the last 2 days. Mm-hmm. And 2 days is enough to let them tell us how upset they are that they're out of their routine.
Yep.
And they don't like being around us and each other all day long.
Yep.
Good times.
And you've gotten the brunt of that because you've been off of work with them. So thank you. But I got the brunt of it at bedtime tonight.
Congratulations.
And you know, the thing about Andrea and these crazy tantrums that she'll have and that whole I wish I wasn't adopted thing, I mean, along with that was running away in her pajamas.
Like out the door?
Yeah. I knew it wouldn't last because it's like 50 degrees out. Yeah, and she was like, she came back, and I think to warm up, and she goes, I'm just here to grab my jacket. I said, well, no, if you're going to run away, you're going to need to wear those clothes. And then she decided that she wanted to stay home. But she'll have these like hour long just hissy fits, and they're actually quite humorous, but of course you don't want to laugh in front of her. And ultimately they always end with her repenting and crying and showing us like how much she truly loves us, and you know, even saying those words. So we got that at the end of it. And I've just learned, like, it's going to come. It will come at the end of this tantrum. That's different for Linda. Linda's are different. But for Andrea, that's going to come. So you just got to kind of wait it out.
I was working during all of that. And it actually sounded like you guys were having fun.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Because she was laughing.
And they're running in and mocking out of the door. And uh-huh. Yeah. I was like, why is Wendy letting them stay up so late? But
yeah. And I was able to keep it really cool. I'm not always able to keep it cool, but I feel like I did. And it actually, that caused the tantrum to go longer, I think, because if she gets what she wants out of me, she gets the rise out of me, then the tantrum's over more quickly. But because she wasn't able to get that out, it took a good hour and a half.
Well, congratulations.
Yep. Thank you.
Some updates on our lives. We mentioned that one of our kids was struggling deeply in school, mm-hmm. and we started looking for tutoring help, mm-hmm. and we hit the jackpot.
Seriously. Our first choice was to ask a friend of ours if she, who is a former teacher, she's on hiatus because she just had her first child, if she might be interested in making a little bit of extra money as a tutor after school.
And she said yes. And then she also said, but you can't pay me anything.
She just said she loves our family and wants to invest in our daughter and her education, and that she would really love to do it. And so she's tutoring our kid twice a week.
For free.
And pouring herself into it. It's so lovely. It's a huge gift to us.
Yeah. And she is clearly, like, even if we had to pay money, she'd still be my first choice, because she's just so professional.
Yeah. And she was our first choice. Yeah.
She knows what she's doing. Like, yeah, this is what she did. And she did it with 30 kids at a time. And now she's just doing it with one, and mm-hmm. same routine, same structure. It's great.
Yeah. Yep. And we're seeing a good response. So
we're very thankful for that. And, you know, I was mentioning to Wendy that a couple of years ago, a friend of ours was complaining that her fifth grader was just spending her entire days reading Harry Potter books. Mm-hmm. And at the time, I thought it was strange to ever hear a mother complain about their child spending all their time reading. And now I would literally pay thousands of dollars to make that happen.
Yeah.
And it's nice to have somebody trying to help her to become that kind of child for free.
Cool.
And we should just mention that she's from our church, and that's not the reason to go to church, but that is a great benefit of church.
Mm-hmm. To have that kind of community.
Yep.
So you have already listened to the interview that you did with Saint. You did a really good job, and you actually, thanks, you intro it on the recording, so I guess we can just move into it. But hey, nice work, honey.
Thanks.
And here's Tim and Saint.
Well, I want to welcome Saint to the Foster Parenting Podcast. Saint, welcome.
All right. Thank you.
I met Saint at the Together for Adoption conference, and he basically retweeted our entire presentation. And with that flattery, I decided I needed to meet him right away. And then I went to a presentation Saint did on foster parenting as well. And for the first time in quite a long time, I felt challenged in a way that I had not felt challenged as a foster parent. So I wanted to bring Saint on to kind of tell you what he told us and me in that presentation. First off, Saint, you were a social worker in the city of St. Louis. That's right. Is that right?
Yes, that is correct.
And you just recently switched careers, but still you had 7 years in child welfare. Is that correct?
That is correct. Yes.
See, those were not excellent interview questions, because they were not leading. They were leading questions. I'm allowing you to say yes and no.
Perfect.
Well, first off, you in your presentation, you talked about, you kind of gave the perspective of the birth families in a foster care situation. And why don't you just run with that? Present to us what it's like to be a birth family.
Well, the reason I like to talk about that is I think there is, at least in this area, there's a fear of, with foster families about birth families. And I think a lot of times that fear is unfounded when you start to look at what the actual facts are regarding child abuse and neglect. But before I even get into that, I mean, just thinking from the perspective of a foster parent, or not a foster parent, of a birth parent, I know when I leave my son with people just for a short time, I'm often concerned and worried about him and the caretaking abilities of people I know and that I'm generally related to or friends with. So I can't imagine being a birth parent and having your child being cared for by somebody you don't know, that you may not have met yet, and that when you do meet them, you're given limited information. And it always kind of struck me as a little ridiculous that we treat foster parenting almost like you know, like a spy network. There's a lot of covert operations, a lot of information that's not disclosed. So for a long time, I've been trying to wrap my head around why does this continue? And so not getting good answers to that, I started to look at like what's actually happening in child abuse and neglect and in foster care.
Well, I can imagine a reason why, you know, there's the spy network and all this fear, because, you know, if people have hurt their kids, then and you're part of a system that took those kids away, well, we're kind of worried about how they're going to react. If they could hurt their kids, what's to think that they can't hurt foster parents or social workers?
Which is, that concept is a great concept for foster parents to keep in mind, and I do agree with that. I think the problem with that is that's not actually what is happening in the system. And just straight statistics, we know that over half of the cases of children who enter foster care are due to neglect, not actual abuse.
Right.
And that's a big concept that needs to get out there. Like, we're not talking about people that are you know, hitting their kids, that are causing sexual abuse. We're talking about neglect issues, and most of those are lack of supervision or houses that are unsafe to live in.
Mm-hmm.
Not people who are intentionally hurting kids. So let's break it down and look at actual abuse cases. In physical abuse cases, most of those cases are actually discipline issues. So in that respect, it may not always be somebody who's intentionally hurting their kid. It may be somebody who has grown up in a system where they know that using a belt for discipline has been what's happened for generations in their family, but not realizing that it's probably not appropriate anymore. But even taking that into consideration, most physical abusers and most sexual abusers are not actually parents. Most sexual abuse perpetrators are extended family members like cousins or paramours, you know, boyfriends and girlfriends of actual biological parents. So in many times, the person that we fear the most is not actually the person who's hurt the child. And that really kind of should change the way we look at dealing with birth parents. The fear is not often founded, if that makes sense.
Yeah, basically what you're saying is, in the case of physical and sexual abuse, the birth parent is at fault, not for abusing them, but for failing to protect them from the abuse.
Exactly. That's exactly it.
And so in a foster care situation, when you have the birth parent around, the birth parent is no longer the birth parent's not responsible for keeping the children safe from abuse in that case. Now it's the foster parent who's carrying that responsibility. So at a birth parent visit, right away, the foster parent or whoever's doing the visit will know who's allowed to show up and who's not allowed to show up. And if somebody shows up who's not allowed to show up, well, that's just the end of the visit right from the get-go.
Right. And it's also when you look at it from that perspective, if the parent's not actually the person who hurt the child, the parent's problem is that they failed to protect the child. Mm-hmm. It should put a different perspective on how we interact with the parent. This isn't somebody who intentionally hurt their kids. This is somebody who didn't know better or made a bad decision that ended up in the hurt of their kids. That's somebody who needs to be mentored and taught, not somebody who needs to be punished and, you know, given limited access to their children.
Hmm. Wow. Well, you're hitting a little close to home, so I'm not sure I want you to keep going, but because that's, as our listeners know, that's kind of the situation we're in. Our children's birth parent. Well, we haven't really gotten into too many details, but basically what you're describing is the case that she wasn't the abuser as much as the neglecter, and she failed to make sure the kids avoided people who might hurt them. So, yeah, like I said, you're hitting a little close to home, but let's keep going. So based on that the birth parent isn't necessarily an abuser and more than likely is a neglecter rather than an abuser. What do you recommend for foster parents?
Well, first let's look at the way this system is designed today. And I'm going to speak kind of generically, so it may change by state. But in most cases, the way the system's designed is that parents get a limited amount of contact with their kids, whether it's one visit a month or two visits a month. So even saying weekly visits a month, I don't know a lot of visits that last, you know, several hours. So we'll say an average two-hour visit once a week. So for 8 hours a month, we're expecting a parent who might be a neglecter, clearly doesn't have parental knowledge, is lacking some particular skills in parenting, but we expect them to use 8 hours a month and some class that they're probably required to attend to fix all the problems that have existed with their ability to parent.
Hmm.
To me, that just seems ridiculous. Now you go to some states that have one visit a month, and you're thinking you spend more time watching a television show every week than these parents get to actually practice the skills that they're supposed to be developing.
Hmm.
So the gap there is that somebody has to be able to step in and do two things. One, somebody has to help mentor, teach those skills to the birth parents. And then birth parents need to have continued exposure to their children. We need to continue that bond and continue to develop it. That's not the way the system's designed. So my kind of radical idea is that this is where I would expect foster parents, and not expect, but hope that foster parents would be able to fill the gap, and to do things that aren't always done right now by foster parents, which could include, having meals together once a week or several times a week, having a foster parent teach a birth parent, like, this is how you make a real meal. You know, it's not always food you pick up from the mini mart or fast food place. Like, here's how to make a basic meal. Mm-hmm. Bath time is a big one. We have a lot of parents I've worked with don't understand the concepts of even helping their kids take a bath and putting them to bed. And these are simple skills that parents learn as they have children, but that for whatever reason, many of the families we end up working with are lacking these really basic things. And when many of the families that I've worked with are in this kind of generational issue of poor parenting, of young parents, of generational issues where they've continued to be in the foster care system. So nobody at any time has developed these skills and knowledge, and nobody at any time has been able to impart that. And we know the state's not going to do it. We know state social workers aren't going to do it. And we know that parenting classes don't do it. Because if they did, the problem would be fixed. So somewhere, somebody has to pick up the ball to step in.
And so you're mentioning some rather intimate moments there, cooking a meal, teaching somebody how to cook a meal, and how to give a child a bath. That clearly has to happen either in the birth parent's house or the foster family's house.
Right. Which brings me back to the CIA and the spy. So, of course, in my mind, that means that foster parents open their homes to birth parents more. And I've talked to enough foster parents to know that that's often just considered an absolutely insane concept. But again, when we look at reality, if we're looking at people who are not necessarily abusers, if we're looking at people who may not have even been the perpetrator of any type of abuse or neglect, that's not necessarily somebody you couldn't allow into your home. To follow that, what I always found it funny when I talk to foster parents and they say, well, I can't give out my last name, or I can't mm-hmm. give out, where I live. And I'm thinking, if I Google your name, I'm probably going to get the information anyway. So we're trying to protect public information that's likely already out there. That's kind of absurd. But then to follow that with, we're worried about giving our addresses out because we're worried about people coming to our house to do who knows what to children that technically are their children.
Mm-hmm.
So then I started looking through, trying to go through news archives and look for actual instances where this has become a problem. And there's not a lot of instances out there where biological parents have had any type of physical confrontations with foster parents, at least in the news. Now, in my experience, that I've never seen that happen. I've never seen a biological parent kidnap their kid in foster care either. From the actual foster parent's home. Now, I do know there are instances where we have kids run away, but for the vast majority of things, at least in my experience, the fear that we have of biological parents doing something at a foster parent's house just doesn't happen.
Hmm. And I really appreciate that you did the research on that, because that's who Tim and Wendy are. You know, we want to know what the research is. Do you think that the lack of incidents is because foster parents are being vigilant about not handing out their home addresses, and they are being careful about not, you know, revealing their last names? Or is that a cause, or is that a correlation, I guess, is my question.
Well, I think it's that definitely contributes to it. I mean, if we're not sharing home addresses, obviously nothing can happen at a home address. But at the same time, I don't think it's going to happen even if we do share that information. In Missouri, we have two counties, Dunklin and Stoddard County, that are actually known in our state for foster parents that share these kind of moments and open their homes up with biological parents.
Mm-hmm.
They also have one of the highest reunification rates in our entire state. And I would say that's directly, that's part of the reason why.
Wow.
But you also have to think about who biological parents are. Many of the biological parents I've worked with are not going to sit on a 2-hour bus ride to come to your house and cause a bunch of problems. They simply don't have the time to take a bus or the money to do it. Most of the people I've worked with, if they have a car, are very reluctant to use the car for anything other than work or their court ordered activities already.
Hmm.
So even just looking from that perspective, like, it's simply not worth the time and effort to cause problems, especially when you're already involved with the court system.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm totally with you. Except that I know a foster parent, and I brought this up with you in person. I know a foster parent whose foster child was kidnapped from them in a public place by a birth mother who is going to be reunified within the week. So clearly she wasn't rational.
Right.
That was probably one of the stupidest things done by a birth parent in the foster care system, because there was just no reason for it. But she, that's kind of the fear of foster parents, is that we fear we're not dealing with somebody who's rational, and we don't know what they're going to do. So I have a question here. I'm just going to find it again. So I totally hear what you're saying, and that point about reunification being higher with foster parents who do open up their homes. That's really convicting. But I still want to feel vigilance for myself and my own family. I want to recommend to foster parents, hey, check it out. You know, like get all the dirt on the birth family before you do that. Do you disagree with any of that?
No. And I absolutely agree. Like you do need to be careful and you do need to do due diligence and find out what's happening. With that said, I would also say that state agencies tend to paint a more negative picture of birth parents than may actually be what's happening. And of course, I mean, there are always cases of worst case scenario, mm-hmm. And so I cannot say that, if you open your house to a birth parent that, everything's going to be high fives and hugs for here on out. It's going to get messy. People's lives are messy, and especially in the system. Right. And there's always that potential. So, yeah, I would say, do your due diligence and set up boundaries. I mean, don't show up for your first meeting and say, hey, come over and we'll watch movies all night. It's a gradual process that you want to get into. But I would say, just starting with a little more openness and starting with maybe a visit that you supervise, if your state allows you to be a supervisor of a visit, is a good step to, having increased contact with kids and their biological parents can help build the trust a little more.
Yeah. And I for sure agree with that if you can be doing the visitations as the foster parent, you should. You talked in your session about, if you were going to send your kids to somebody else's house, you'd want to show up there. You'd want to know what it's like there. You'd want to know what kind of people are taking care of them. And birth parents are no different. They just don't have a choice, but they still have the same concerns. And so, yeah, showing up to birth parent visits is a great idea, just so they know who you are. And so that, if you view your foster kids as your kids, don't you want to be there, when they're having these major life events and meeting their birth parents? Don't you want to control the situation as much as you can? So yeah, I for sure advocate showing up at birth parent visits. Maybe the takeaway from your challenge is to start asking questions of your social worker. Hey, would this be okay? Are these people safe enough to have over to my home? If they're not, the social worker will clearly tell you, no, don't have them anywhere near you.
Right. And be prepared for that to be the answer.
Yeah.
Often.
I think that just naturally for all foster parents, we just assume that every birth parent is that worst case scenario, is the person who's on meth right now and has, a history of gun violence. That's part of our heroic narrative, is that we have to make the birth parents those kind of people, right?
Right.
So maybe we need to start, asking those kind of questions of the social worker to remove that narrative from our own perceptions.
Well, and we have to kind of look at what the whole concept of the foster care system is kind of based on. A lot of it's based on the concept of redemption. And if not willing to give people the opportunity to redeem themselves, what's the point of the system?
Yeah.
And I think the pendulum swings, every so often, and we go really liberal and really conservative, just depending on the time of whenever we're at. And I think right now we're on a fairly conservative pendulum swing where we're not really looking for rehabilitation and redemption. We're looking at, we're really focused on child's best interest and children's health and well-being, but oftentimes that includes family. And what, you know, one thing I always like to say is, I know I have some very insane family members that I probably don't always want around my children. And of course, I think everybody has those people, but recognize they may also have children. Those are some of the birth parents, you know, they're the same as the crazy uncle that you have. But that doesn't always mean that they're dangerous.
Yeah. Something else you mentioned in your session was, St. Louis really strove to reduce the number of, foster care placements. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So, in the early 90s, our family court system really became a machine, that took custody of lots of children and terminated parental rights very quickly. Which has led to a large contingent of kids that are older than the age of 10 that have sat in foster care for a decade or more.
Wow.
Which huge problem. And we know that, you know, as kids get to that age bracket of 10 and above, they're less and less likely to be adopted or to even see any kind of permanency. We know that kids that sit in foster care for longer than 3 years, have like an 80% less chance of leaving the system. Mm-hmm. So we were in quite the predicament. So St. Louis City is only, it's 11 miles long and, 7 miles wide. It's a very, very small city inside of the actual St. Louis County.
Mm-hmm.
So very small area, and we had almost 3,000 kids in foster care.
Wow.
So we partnered with the Annie E. Casey Foundation and went through their family to family program,
mm-hmm.
which had several different initiatives, everything from recruitment and retention of foster parents to, initiatives on strengthening and building families. But one that we found that worked, particularly well was a program called Team Decision Making.
Mm-hmm.
And the concept is that anytime a child, has any sort of change in legal status or change of placement, a meeting is held beforehand to make sure that that's the right decision that's made. So what that looks like, especially for us, is that anytime one of our child abuse investigators thinks that they need to take custody of a child, whether legal or physical,
mm-hmm.
they have a meeting before that actually happens. It's facilitated by a third-party person who's unrelated to the case. The investigator is there. Their supervisor's there. The family is invited. The family is allowed to bring any support that they have, you know, friends, mm-hmm. family, whoever. And then we also try to invite somebody from the community, somebody who's grassroots, who's hopefully from the area that the family's from. And we sit down and we really put everything out on the table. And it's, we talk to the family and say, here are the issues in the course of the investigation. Here are the facts that we came up with. And this is what we think we need to do to make sure that your child is safe. And what we mm-hmm. found in doing this is that, one, when families are dealt with truthfully and upfront in a very transparent way, they're much more cooperative with state agencies. And for us, that meant helping us find safe alternatives that may not have been foster care.
Got it.
I've been in meetings where you think a family has no support system, and then we have 24 aunts, uncles, and cousins coming through the doors requesting background checks to be placements for kids.
Wow.
Which is great for us because we can alleviate kids coming in foster care.
Right.
We also found that when we add people from the community, they advocate for families that they live by, and they then connect with those families and build better networks within the community. So we've had one case that I worked on personally, had a mother who had a crack addiction and would go on binges a lot. And
mm-hmm.
The community member called some people in the neighborhood who set up kind of a safekeeping group for these children who, if mom was going to go out on a binge, they would step in and the kids could stay with them for any given time. And then the community member helped the mom connect to a drug treatment program that was across the street from her house.
Wow.
Which for us was a huge win. So we got treatment, we got safekeeping, and we had a community looking after a family who was in dire straits. So the program's been great. It brings transparency to families. It really takes the concept of taking custody away from one person and puts mm-hmm. it on a group of people who make the decision together. It connects families to new support networks. And then what we found was it really helped our investigators differentiate between risk and safety. And we have a lot of families who are high-risk families, but that doesn't always mean that their kids are in are having issues with safety. It doesn't mean they're not safe. It means that we may need to connect them with something to alleviate the risk, but they may not need to lose their children.
Right. That's good. And basically, if I've got this idea right, no social worker makes a solo decision about taking kids into custody. And the birth parents actually get a chance to explain themselves to a group of people making that decision, and they can bring anybody they want into that to say, oh no, you don't need to put them in a foster care. You know, we can help. Here's this cousin over here. Here's a grandmother. Here's the church network that can step in instead of you, the state, doing it.
Right. That's it. That's exactly it. And it's, well, what's been interesting is when, in some cases I've seen where custody is taken, like the parents understand at the end of the process that the children can't stay safe with them. You know, they're not thrilled, but they understand. And that, I mean, I think that's been huge too, to even say, like, you understand why this has to happen, and let's do something to make sure it doesn't have to happen again.
Yeah. And can I just ask, like, how do you keep parents from being a flight risk? Like, if they know that this meeting's coming, and they might already know that they're not going to be able to justify their parental rights. Did they ever take off, or did they?
And it fascinates. I have no idea why nobody ever runs away, but it just doesn't happen.
Wow.
And I just have to laugh. And I think it's because people honestly think they're doing the best job they can. And that kind of led me into the whole concept of opening yourself to birth parents more. When you see people come to the table to advocate for what they were doing, they honestly believe that what they were doing was right. And a lot of times it's not, but a lot of times it can be alleviated through other means too. So I think you see that a lot. You know, parents, and you know, like I said, if parents aren't the actual perpetrator, they're also coming in and saying, why are you taking my kids from me? I didn't hurt my kids.
Right. And so in a situation where you decided that the kids needed to be taken into foster care, was it just right then and there, like the kids are at the meeting and you know, you've got the police there or whatever you need to start that process, or do you have to go pick them up right after the meeting?
If kids are old enough to talk in the meeting, we certainly want to make sure that they are in the meeting so they can voice their side of the story as well. Sometimes we try to make sure there's a safe place for the kids to stay that everybody's comfortable with. Sometimes that's relatives or sometimes school. But it can happen in all number of ways. I've even been in situations where we've had to go back to the birth family's home to pick the child up, which was pretty awkward, but worked out in the long run, I guess.
Yeah, and they didn't run, huh?
They again, fascinates me that they didn't run, because I think that's what I would have done. So, yeah.
Wow.
But to go back, so St. Louis City at one time had almost 3,000 kids in foster care. I think in 2000 was our high point, and we are a little over 700 now.
Wow.
Yeah, so less than a third of the kids at our high point.
Yeah, and many of those kids were kids that you took in at your high point.
Yes, unfortunately, we do have a large contingent of older youth that are all teenagers now that were part of that original process.
Wow. Well, that's really encouraging that you found something other than foster care. I love foster care, but I think it's terrible. You know, like, right. I can say that with a straight face. I think it's a great system, and I think you should do everything in the world to make sure kids never enter it. So that's good to hear that you found a way to reduce the number of kids coming into foster care.
Yeah, well, I think the biggest thing we got out of the family-to-family programs was a change in the way we thought about safety and risk and the families that we work with. And so we do much more preventative work up front now than erring on, I guess, making sure everybody's, you know, not at risk. And, you know, so instead of taking custody of kids because you have a bad feeling, it's actually doing more investigative work and seeing if we can't put something in place ahead of time.
That's great. That's great. Well, Saint, thanks so much for coming on. We really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah. Well, and thanks again for all your hard work for families and kids. All right. A little too controversial for you? What do you think?
Challenging, for sure. Like you said, he challenges past what we're comfortable with. And so now, because we sometimes feel like we're challenging people that we meet about
becoming foster parents
and becoming more open.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people we meet aren't interested in any kind of contact after a placement. Like, so to take that next step, even I'm feeling that discomfort and all the reasons, you know, like, obviously there's a lot of reasons and you stated some of them in the interview. There's a lot of reasons not to have the kind of contact he's talking about. But it's helpful to have him put out there that there are reasons to have that contact. So
yeah. And, you know, I mentioned the story of the foster parent who kidnapped her child a week before reunification. And before I say anything else, I just want to say that was totally her fault. Mm-hmm. The foster parents are friends of ours. It was not their fault. It was her fault. Mm-hmm. But I wonder if that situation would have been different if they had been doing the visits at home. Like, it would have been less likely for her to have been able to get away with that if they were in the house rather than in a public place. And again, that is not on the foster parents at all. But I think even in that crazy situation, maybe what Saint's talking about might have made things better.
Yeah, like I guess I would disagree with you there, because When I hear that about that kind of crazy, I'm like, no, that's never coming into my house, that kind of crazy.
Good point.
Especially because we know that family already has another child as well. So now they know where we live. Not only am I and my spouse in danger, but now and the child we're fostering, but also our child. And shoot.
Yeah. But nobody knew that she was that kind of crazy, the birth mother.
Yeah.
Otherwise, she wouldn't have been moving towards reunification like that. It came out of the blue.
Yeah, good point. And so what's to keep other things from coming out of the blue?
Which is another argument against what Saint's talking about.
Yep. Yeah.
Sorry, Saint.
No, but again, there's a great value in what he's sharing, because it goes about, I think, putting that question in your mind of that being a possibility. And I think I needed that. So,
yeah. And I want everybody to always think, could I do that with this birth parent? The answer is not necessarily yes every time, mm-hmm. or even most times. But I think it's important for every foster parent to be asking that question.
And, you know, like you guys mentioned in the interview as well, you don't just make that decision on your own with the birth parent. Like, you talk to your caseworker about it, and you talk to your social worker, your guardian ad litem, or, you know, whatever your state has. And you all make that decision together, because, you know, I can also see, you know, if we made that decision with kids who were in our care through foster care, it may be that the social worker did not want to disclose where the child was, because technically that child is in the care of the state. And so that, you know, that social worker might feel like that's putting the placement at risk. And, you know, so they need to be part of that decision.
Right. Naturally.
Well, everybody have a great Christmas and New Year.
Yes. That's it for today. To leave a comment or ask a question, please visit our website, fosterpodcast.com.
Or send an email to info@fosterpodcast.com. We will read it, and we might respond.
Months later.
Yeah, sorry, guys.
Names have been changed on this podcast to protect the privacy of those involved.
Foster parenting is the most heart-wrenching, frustrating, all-consuming thing we've ever done.
But when it gets down to it, it's just about helping kids. And that's been the most rewarding thing in our lives.
If you've ever thought you might adopt or foster, we challenge you to take the next step today.